Coming up on this week's show, the Atari 400 gets the mini treatment.
Konami announced some big re-releases.
And we go inside the world of obscure consoles and computers with Lewis Packwood.
The Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one of their books you absolutely need to check out, Super Nintendo / Super Famicom, a visual compendium. Now, this pays homage to one of the greatest consoles ever made and its incredible library of games and the people who brought these amazing ideas to life. So if you're a fan of Nintendo 16-bit wonder, check that book out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our lovely friends at PCBWay. Now, you know PCBWay. They offer fully featured custom PCB prototyping, low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and they offer services like 3D printing and injection molding. And you know that PCBWay are huge supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote right now on their website at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 412, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And very nice to have you joining us for another episode where we get to geek out for an hour-ish. Actually around 90 minutes normally, but you know, that doesn't sound as catchy for a podcast title. Where we talk about classic video games, technology, bring you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro from over the last 7 days, and of course bring you an incredible guest in the second half of the show as well. And we just love doing this podcast. I mean, that's the thing about us guys. I mean, for people that might be new to the show, you know, we never claim to be like experts on this kind of thing, do we? All we are is guys that love video games who like hanging out and talking about it.
Yeah, and we've done it for quite a long time now. Yeah.
Over 8 years of doing this podcast every single week. So if you have just found us recently, because I don't want to, you know, blow our own trumpet or anything, but you've been sharing a few stats with us recently, Ravi. We've kind of hit 2024 running, really, haven't we, in terms of, you know, the podcast charts and the stats and all that recently?
Yeah, it's been really good. And, you know, thanks so much for everybody listening. It's great. I think we're number 7 in the iTunes charts, which was pretty amazing to see. And Dan, you've also been betraying us and going on to other services.
Yes, I mean, I have been doing a bit of moonlighting over the last couple of weeks. I kind of forgot about this because it was something I recorded at the start of December, day after my birthday, actually, which might explain why my voice is slightly croaky on this episode if you listen to it. But this was a documentary that I was invited to take part in that was on the BBC. Now, this was broadcast on BBC Radio 4, which is a, you know, terrestrial radio station here in the UK for people outside the UK, and also released on a podcast on BBC Sounds as well. And it's a series that they do called Toast. Now, it's quite an interesting concept for a show. It's about basically companies that, you know, were like riding high and then suddenly everything went wrong and, you know, they got toasted, essentially. So they've done episodes on, like, you know, Blockbuster was a recent episode they did on there as well. They've done one on their Toys R Us. And they have a journalist on there called Sean. And basically, his serial entrepreneur co-host, Sam White, her name is, they sum up kind of why these companies failed. And, you know, if we're talking about computer companies, obviously the one I was invited on to talk about was the Commodore episode.
I think it's always something that people discuss eternally. Yeah. Which is, why did this company fail and what would have happened if this changed? And I find this quite interesting because, you know, going on to the BBC and stuff, our audience have probably heard that story a million times.
Yeah.
But, you know, going out there for the mainstream thing is really cool.
Yeah, and it was awesome. You know, there's a guy called Tim who's the editor of PC Pro magazine. He was on it as well. David Pleasance, you know, who our good friend who used to be the former managing director of Commodore. And Amiga's basically just like, you know, an Amiga and Commodore super fan, really. So I'll play a couple of seconds of it if you want to hear kind of how the episode sounds.
Dan, from a gaming perspective, Dan Wood, who's a super fan, what came next from your perspective after the Commodore 64?
Well, we were, you know, a Commodore household, really. You know, after we got the initial 8-bit machines in the 80s, we moved on to the Amiga, which was Commodore's flagship brand in the late 80s and through to their demise in the mid 90s. So, yeah, I got an Amiga 500 Plus model for Christmas 1991. It didn't feel like jumping one generation. It felt like a computer from the future. When the Amiga was launched, you know, the Mac was still black and white. You know, the PC was basically just beeping at the DOS prompt. And then the Amiga came along, 4,096 colors. It had, you know, stereo sound as well. I remember a friend of mine who had an Amstrad computer coming to my house and experiencing the music on Amiga games, and his jaw dropped. And he went home and asked his mum that night, I need an Amiga 500.
Stories that I've told before on this podcast, but like you said, Ravi, the fact that I could talk about that kind of stuff on BBC Radio 4, still a bit surreal.
And you've got your phone voice on as well, I can tell.
Like I said, trying not to sound too hungover after my birthday night out night before. But yeah, so if you want to check that out, I mean, it was like an hour long that we recorded, and they edited the whole thing down to around 24 minutes. So, you know, there's kind of a lot on the cutting room floor. But I think, you know, still the fact that the mainstream, that the BBC are covering this kind of thing now, I do think it's very cool. So
yeah, it's cool. I saw they did one on the Spectrum as well. Not the Spectrum, on the Sinclair C5.
Which, yes, they did. Yeah, yeah, you're right. So yeah, it's a really interesting series, actually. So if you want to check that out, it's on their BBC Sounds Now, or you can, I think they're still repeating it on Radio 4 at certain points as well, but I'll link that up in our show notes as well. Now, we have got lots of stories to get into this week, and we're going to be talking about obscure systems in the second half of the podcast today. Now, you guys know that, you know, I'm a bit of a fan of the kind of the failed and weird systems, you know, that I collect for the Atari Jaguar, you know, that I've got a Philips CDI and a Commodore CD TV. But those systems are, quite frankly, mainstream compared to the systems we're going to be talking about with our guest this week, Lewis Packwood. Now, we've had Lewis on the podcast before, and he's done some incredible books and documentaries in the past. We're still talking to Lewis, don't we?
Yeah, I really love this book that he's kind of created, and this is you know, Curious Video Game Machines. And honestly, I have not heard of half of these machines in there. There's a few things that we've talked about before, but God, he's gone into detail with stuff.
Well, I'm going to test Joe on these before we get into it. Have you heard of the Interton Video Computer 4000? Have you heard of that before?
I'm on one right now.
Yeah, looking at your vast collection of them.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sat on a throne of Interton.
Of course
what
you are.
What are they called?
Interton VC, it might be. This is basically a computer that came out of console, actually, an early 8-bit ROM-based, cartridge-based, second-generation video home game console. Mainly popular in Germany. It also was released here as well, apparently. Never heard of it before. France, Spain, Austria, the Netherlands, Australia in 1978. Apparently, the company that were behind it, they were a hearing aid manufacturer who branched out into video games. So we talk about that. What about the MB Microvision? One of those in your collection?
As in the board games MB, Mega Boring.
Yeah, that's them, Milton Bradley. Well, this was the first handheld game console that used interchangeable cartridges. And it was a handheld a decade before the Game Boy.
Well, these aren't that obscure because we've actually got a story about the Casio Loopy later on in the news, which is featured in the book. And,
One more for Joe. Let me give you one more.
What about
the Galaxija? You heard of that before?
The Galaxija?
Yeah.
Is that a limited edition chocolate bar?
Now I'm craving one of those. This was a build-it-yourself computer. And basically it was like, you know, today people build their own kind of cases for Raspberry Pis and that kind of thing. This was basically a main board. You'd build your own case for it back in the day. The ultimate hobbyist machine, an open source computer from Yugoslavia. There's all this stuff out there that, like, you know, we think we've heard a lot about retro gaming and tech. Turns out there's so much more that I need to look out for on eBay now.
Yeah, loads. I used to have this idea of, like, I'm going to get every console that ever came out in the UK. And, like, you think, like, you know, oh, there can't be that many, Sega, Nintendo. And then you just hear about all these crazy things in the 70s and 80s. And like you say, every single, like, electronics company, whether it was hearing aids or, you know, CD Hi-Fi, you know, Sony or whatever, you know, dipping their toes. Obviously,
that one worked out all right.
Yeah, that one worked all right. But just dipping their toes in it and just, you know, the things that came out. And like you say, I did know there was things before the Game Boy, but I couldn't tell you what they were. You know, cards and stuff like that.
It's like different generations have different references to stuff.
That sounds really interesting.
You're a bit younger than us, Joe, as well. So you have a different base than us guys. And, you know, I think Lewis as well, he's a writer, a journalist, so you know, he's wrote stuff for The Guardian, Edge magazine as well, Retro Gamer, Time Extension, so, you know, he's got a big bit of knowledge and kind of skills at research.
He's got the credentials
stuff. Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm listening there. I would pay attention to this week's podcast, guys, because I'm thinking a load of new questions for the Christmas quiz might come out of this episode.
Here we go.
So, you know, pay attention. So, really interesting chat if you want to hear about the more obscure side of video game machines and computers with our guest, Lewis Packwood. He's on the show in around 35 minutes from now. Now, something that isn't obscure to most of the world, but actually we were chatting before we started recording this episode today, none of us have ever owned one of these machines, and actually we haven't really got all that much experience in using them, but this has been the big headline in the world of retro from over the last week. You know, it's been all over YouTube, it's been all over my social timelines, that the next mini console, or a mini computer in this case actually, from Retro Games Limited, of course, who were the company that brought us the Amiga 500 Mini last year, the C64 and VIC-20 Minis, they've now announced that in a couple of months' time, we're going to be getting a mini version of the Atari 400.
Yeah, I think this is a really wise move, actually, because the Atari 400, I've not actually ever seen one in person in the UK. When I was in America, there were a lot of them about, and you know, it's the Atari 8-bit system as well.
Yeah.
And I think this is really cool because they'll obviously hit that nostalgia of the American market, but then the curiosity of other markets and other regions that didn't have it.
Yeah, 100%. And like you said, I mean, it was definitely a system that was more popular in the USA. It was one of the, you know, the first home computers released by Atari back in 1979. Obviously, you think about then, you know, the contemporaries to it were stuff like the Commodore PET and the Apple II and the TRS-80 as well. It's got that membrane keyboard on there, got the cartridge slot on the top. And it wasn't that popular in the UK, you're right. I mean, I've looked at some kind of estimates on their sales. They reckon that they only sold 50,000 units of the Atari 400 and the 800, which was a version with more memory, combined in the UK. So definitely not a machine that we've seen much of over here.
It's something that we've had many guests reference as well as one of their first machines. And it looks like it's got a great history about it, but also, you know, Retro Games Limited, the company behind it, have created a quite a nice piece here, and they've got some good options in there too.
I mean, when you guys sent me this last week when it was announced, I ain't going to lie, because it just said, it, you know, it was the A400 Mini?
The 400 Mini.
The 400 Mini. I thought it was an Amiga.
Yep. Was the one with the model number lower than the Amiga 500, you're thinking?
Yeah. So that confused me a little bit. I'd never heard, well, I probably have heard of the Atari 400, but you know what I'm like with anything that's kind of like pre my era. I'm terrible with it, but this looks pretty cool. So I'm assuming the games are kind of on par with the Atari 2600, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of, I mean, there were some games that came out in the UK in particular. I mean, you know, Jet Set Willy was ported to it as well. You know, Jeff Minty used to do quite a bit on there. I think Matthew Smith did some stuff. Andrew Braybrook, obviously featured in our retro book recently. He made a couple of titles for it as well. The interesting thing about the Atari 400 to me is that really, I mean, you thought then, you know, it wasn't an Amiga. This really is the kind of spiritual kind of grandfather or the father of the Amiga, really, because it was made by Jay Miner, who was, you know, he worked for Atari at the time and then went on to be, you know, one of the principal designers of the Amiga. And this was kind of, you know, it's got a lot of the principles in there that kind of went on to the Amiga afterwards, like, you know, custom chips, you know, for example, that are in this machine. And really a lot of people think, because obviously Commodore released the Commodore 64, a lot of people kind of think of, like, you know, the 64 as like the predecessor to the Amiga, but really it was the Atari 400 and 800. So from that perspective, kind of being the Amiga's ancestor, to me, I've always found that machine interesting from that point of view and wanted to explore it a bit more.
Yeah, and some of the games as well, like, you know, that they mentioned that it's going to come with 25 pre-installed ones.
Yeah.
Berserk Millipede as well, Miner 2049er as well, which is a reference quite a lot. Star Raiders, Mule as well. So they've got some kind of groundbreaking games here.
I think what's quite nice is they outright advertise, you know, in the trailer for it, that it is compatible with emulation of the 400 and 800 XL and also the Atari 5200 home console.
Yeah, because I mean, we were saying when we did that episode with, you know, Ben Jones from PlayOn the other week, you know, Ravi asked him about, you know, could you do Atari 5200 emulation on the 2600 Plus? And he was a bit kind of cagey. He was a bit like, well, you know, maybe we could do that kind of thing. But obviously this was kind of going on behind the scenes, which I imagine you knew about.
yeah, probably, no doubt. But my point was, it's nice that we know, like, they must know, like, when they did the PlayStation Mini, like, a load of my mates, you know, modded theirs and all that, which was really easy to do, and just put, like, hundreds of PlayStation 1 games on there, and, you know, you see the Super Nintendo Mini with loads of other games on there and stuff, and it's like, these companies must know that people do this, and it is actually quite easy to do it. So it's nice to see that they're just like, yeah, you can emulate other games on it, which is great.
Also, this was kind of announced earlier, wasn't it, that there were going to be some releases from Retro Games Limited, and we were kind of speculating and everybody was wondering what they were. And it looks like they're kind of going in the Atari direction, which is interesting because, you know, previously they've released Commodore stuff and Amiga.
And I think, you know, the point you made there, Joe, about the fact that they kind of encourage, you know, people to kind of, you know, put your own ROMs on there, all that kind of thing. Mm. So I don't know if you've seen the A500 Mini recently. There's this thing called Pandori on there, which basically completely opens the system. People are running like PlayStation games, Dreamcast games on them now.
Oh, wow.
Which is like, basically turns it into a great little emulation box, you know, completely breaking out of that, you know, just the Amiga built-in emulation, and they haven't blocked it or anything like that as far as I've seen. So, you know, it does seem like they're maybe, you know, not encouraging it, but letting people do what they want with them. But in terms of the look of this, I mean, obviously you've got that kind of distinctive Atari 400 look, which I've always thought, you know, is a chunky little looking machine, isn't it, the Atari 400? I've seen them at like Play Expo before, and Stephen Jones, when he's demoing his that monitor that he kickstarted a couple of years ago, whenever I see him at events recently, he's always got an Atari 400 plugged into it to kind of demonstrate how that looks on there. So you get a smaller version. They're saying this is a half-size version of the Atari 400. I imagine it doesn't say anything about it on the video or the website as far as I can see, but I imagine the keyboard will be non-functional because it generally always is with these. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. But even, you know, I don't know if that would be cheap to produce a working keyboard for that as well. And, you know, if they haven't got it functional, someone's going to rip it apart and make it functional, aren't they?
Well, it says 5 USB ports, which allow for addition of modern keyboard. So so I would say that's not going to be working, and you got to plug your own one in.
It's the size of it, isn't it? I mean, someone there is a YouTube video, someone did mod the A500 Mini to have, you know, working key. You kind of need a cocktail stick to press the keys down at the tiny. So, I mean, you know, I understand that for the reasons, you know, of size. It's not going to be a comfortable machine to type on. Not that those kind of chiclet keys were in the first place anyway. So that's kind of to be expected now as well. It also comes with a recreation of the Atari CX40 joystick as well. Now, this is interesting because I did kind of mention a moment ago about, you know, the interview we did with Ben Jones from PlayOn, who worked on the Atari 2600 Plus. Apparently, from what I've read, this is in collaboration with PlayOn. So I'm wondering if the joystick that comes with this is the same one that came with the 2600 Plus.
So I'm surprised. Yeah, they do look really similar, don't they? So
it would make sense rather than trying to, you know, do it twice, I suppose, if they're just going to use the same joystick, which, you know, I've got no complaints. I thought that joystick was really nice. A great little feature in here. I mean, obviously you can sideload your own games on by USB stick. It supports cartridge, disc and cassette ROMs as well. It's got a rewind function. And you can save games as well. This rewind function I thought was quite cool. So basically what you can do is you can resume your game at any time, save your game at any time, or you can rewind by up to 30 seconds to help you get past those really difficult parts, which were often the case in 8-bit games.
Yeah, I've played a few, you know, kind of limited run games and games that have been, you know, a couple of years ago, they did The Lion King and Aladdin and Jungle Book, all on Xbox and PlayStation, and they all had like the rewind features in them, and you go, I'm going to play this, I'm going to play it properly, I'm not going to rewind or anything. And then, you know, I think I played a Gynoog for the Mega Drive the other week on Xbox, and yeah, I'm just rewinding every time I die.
Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, to me, it's like having these conveniences in there. You know, if some people are like purists and like, well, that wasn't in the original. If that was in the original systems back in the day, you know, we would have used them. Rather than starting the game all over again.
You need it to complete a game, Dan.
I needed to get to the second level of most games. Yeah. So, I think that's definitely a welcome addition. And again, you don't have to use it if you don't want it. You know, it's just a feature that's in there if you wish to use it. And also, I mean, they've paid a lot of attention to it as well. They said, you know, from the hard-to-match colours of the original machine, the authentic textures of the plastic as well, they've really kind of tried to make it, you know, a tribute to the original Atari 400, which I think is really nice. And I think they did a good job with the A500 Mini in terms of the, you know, the plastic color and the feel of it as well. So I've got every faith that this will be equally as good as that. So, and I think it's very interesting to see as well, like you said, Ravi, it's I've had a lot of people kind of message me going, well, I didn't see that one coming. You know, that's a bit left of center, because I think a lot of people were expecting maybe another Commodore machine, maybe, you know, there's rumors of a CD32 Mini, you know, some people were talking about last year.
I think, you know, that may be a little bit too obscure, but as you know, my predictions aren't amazing on this kind of thing. But, you know, one thing that stands out to me is Atari is absolutely killing it. They're pumping out so much stuff at the moment, and a lot of stuff based on their legacy. and, you know, licensing out different companies, but also like choosing the right ones as well that are producing quality stuff. You know, there was a lot of older Atari, let's say, TAT machines that came out in the past, and you know, these ones look pretty decent.
Yeah, and I'm very excited about this as someone who, you know, I've got pretty much all the mainstream kind of, you know, 8-bit micros in my collection, I'd say now, but the Atari 400 is one that I've always really wanted but never got hold of. So I think for me, this will definitely be, you know, a must-have machine. So it's available from the 28th of March, so only a few months to wait, and pre-orders for that are available now. I haven't checked the prices yet. Let me just quickly check on the UK prices.
£99.
That's not bad, actually, is it? Yeah, I think that's really reasonable. So nice-looking box as well. So if you want to check that Amazon link and the trailer for that, I'll put that in the show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, some rather exciting news from Konami this week as well, who've announced some classic re-releases.
Oh yeah, baby, this is up my street. So
it is.
Our friends at a Limited Run and Konami, interestingly, who, you know, aren't really making any new games at the moment and releasing old games. So, you know, this hasn't come out of the blue or anything like that, no pun intended, but they have announced this week via Limited Run and Konami two games, actually, so two collections. So we'll go through the first one first, which I absolutely love. This is one of my favorite Mega Drive games of all time, to a point where I actually have a tattoo of him on my shin. Rocket Knight Adventures Resparked Collection, which I am super excited about. Do you guys know the Rocket Knight games? Familiar
Not
with them?
At all.
I remember you showed me your tattoo and I was like, oh, can I have heard of that game? I vaguely remember it, but it's not a game that I've played. I feel like I should have played it there. Because we were talking before, we're going to do like an after-hours episode for our patrons of kind of games that we probably should have played, but we haven't. Is this a game you suggest people should play?
This will be a game I suggest then in that case, maybe for both of you. But yeah, Rocket Knight Adventures was a 1993 action platformer where you played as a possum, funny enough.
I wonder where they're inspired from. Yeah.
And he wears blue armor. But the aim of the game is a platform adventure, you know, action platformer, kind of set in a steampunk medieval kind of, you know, world where there's an evil pig army and they kidnap the princess and you as the possum have to rescue her. And you know, you can, it's hard to describe, but it's a platformer game, you know, where you jump and you have a sword and, you know, when you slash your sword, it kind of shoots a beam of energy across the screen. That's your attack. But if you hold down the jump button, you charge up your rocket, your jetpack, and you just jetpack all over the level. And it makes really unique and interesting kind of platforming, if that makes sense. And there's a whole load of different levels where you have to get into giant pig mechs and fight, you know, other pig mechs, and levels where you are, it's a shoot 'em up and you're flying along when your jetpack, you know, shooting at people and stuff. Really, really fun game.
I'm watching a playthrough now on YouTube. The graphics look awesome on it as well.
It was absolutely fantastic, beautiful game. And it was followed by a sequel called Sparkster, Rocket Knight Adventures 2, because you played as Sparkster, which came out in 94, which personally, they changed the kind of the controls a little bit too much and the platforming a little bit too much for my liking, but it's still quite a well-loved game. And then there was a Super Nintendo version spin-off, which was just called Sparkster, which also came out in 1994.
Was like a Wonder Dog, like a rip-off of this then? Or
I think they're all just a rip-off of Sonic, let's be honest.
Quite similar, yeah.
But yeah, Rocket Knight Adventure, often, you know, in kind of top 10 Mega Drive games, you know, for a lot of people, a lot of lists you'll see on YouTube and stuff. But the reason we're talking about it is Limited Run are going to be releasing this, and it is going to go for pre-order on January 19th, which I believe is the day this episode airs. Yep, Friday, January 19th, which will be on for about a month because it's Limited Run and obviously, you know, fear of missing out and all that jazz. And it's going to be $35 and it's going to be available.
Bad.
Yeah, it's not bad. You get all three games. It's going to be available on Switch and on PS4 and PS5. No news of it coming out on Xbox, but sometimes Limited Run, they kind of release the Xbox ones later. They don't always come on Xbox. And it does come with a limited edition mini comic as well, which was actually included in a issue of Sega Magazine back in the day, in the mid-90s or 93, I imagine, which is really cool. And obviously, with it being Limited Run, there is, you know, plenty of other things you can buy, you know, other Ultimate Editions, which...
You know, you can spend a lot more money, I've seen, on here if you want to.
Yeah, yeah, hell of a lot
$134 for the Ultimate Edition.
Yeah, which, you know, always come with, like, you know, pins and stuff like that. But it does come with a really cool clamshell case, which, you know, recreates the original Genesis Mega Drive Sega box, which I do love, but these things can get pricey, and they are going to be releasing, and it does... you know, warrant this. It has got a fantastic soundtrack, but they are going to be re-releasing the soundtracks on vinyl, plushies, everything. They're going to absolutely town on this. Yeah, on cassette as well. Really going to town on this. But as well as this, a month later, now this is a game I'm not particularly familiar with. Well, I'm not familiar with at all.
When I saw this, like, from the recesses of my brain, suddenly it re-emerged and I got all, like, nostalgic and, ooh.
Vaguely remember this, watching the TV show of this, but Felix the Cat.
Yeah, move over Mickey Mouse. Felix the Cat was, like, the original basic animal on cinema, you know. Yeah. It was from silent movies.
1919, apparently.
Yeah, 1919, yeah, because I collect silent movies, which, you know, on a Blu-ray and stuff like that. And Felix the Cat was really, really good stuff. You know, they did stuff with Charlie Chaplin as well. But then I remember there was a series called the Twisted Tales of Felix the Cat.
Yeah.
And that was on TV when I was young.
Yeah.
And, you know, Felix the Cat has kind of disappeared from popular culture. And just seeing, you know, that character again, I'm just like, oh my God. And realizing that there was a peak in the 90s and that they're kind of going back to, you know, the 93 Game Boy titles.
And your mate apparently voiced Lani Manella.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
There you go.
Voiced Felix the Cat apparently in the 2000s, I've just seen. So.
Oh, wow. Yes. Funny that. But yeah, they are going to be doing the Felix the Cat bundle with limited run once again on Switch, PS4, PS5. This is going to be releasing for pre-order February 9th to March 10th. Only two games of that one. As Ravi's just said, it is a NES title, which was called Felix the Cat, and a Game Boy game, which came out in 93, as Ravi just said, called Felix the Cat. Not familiar with those two, but I'm fairly certain I've seen people praising the NES game before the Nintendo game.
Cats were big in the 90s.
They were.
Garfield, Felix the Cat. Yeah. You know, they were all rocking it.
But yeah, as always, you know, limited run, absolutely killing it. They're definitely onto a good thing here. And using the Carbon engine, which I've just, you know, been Googling before we kind of came on air, and the Carbon engine is the game engine that they use, which allows, you know, old games to be ported onto new systems. That's how they're doing it. And it's something they created themselves, which I think is really cool. And as I was kind of Googling around, Konami have announced that next month on the 19th, oh, sorry, on the 24th of February, they are going to be announcing further re-releases through Limited Run using the Carbon engine, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, these games, the games they pick out, I mean, I'm not familiar. I mean, I know the characters, but I haven't played, you know, any of the Felix Cat games or Rocket Knight Adventures. But I know, you know, for fans of the original games, having these classics updated for a modern hardware and having a physical edition of them. So now, I mean, I was watching a video the other day kind of laying into Limited Run games, if I'm honest. It was like an hour and a half documentary. So I understand there are, you know, there's not everyone's a fan of this kind of thing. But my opinion always has been that, you know, if you don't like it, just don't buy it. So I think, you know, for people that do want this, I mean, you know, for stuff like this, which is, you know, people have held close to the heart and the beloved things from their childhood, being able to get them again in like a modern format, I think is, you know, as a collector, that's something really nice to have in your collection. Yeah. So, and I think the price of this as well, I mean, some of their releases can be very expensive, but like $34 for, you know, a collection of this that you can run on your Switch on your shelf, I think it's decent.
You've completely hit the nail on the head there. Like, I love the Rocket Knight game. So for me, that's a no-brainer. It was one of my favorite games growing up.
Yeah.
And you've just said it there. Like, if you're not a fan of it, if you weren't a fan of that game, just don't buy it. You know, you don't have to buy it. There's other people who will enjoy it.
It's not mandatory.
I'm not a big fan. I have no real affiliation with Felix the Cat. That's cool. Doesn't upset me that they're doing it.
Just don't buy it, Jim.
So just don't buy it. There we go. But yeah, really looking forward to Rocket Knight Adventures Resparked.
Yeah, so pre-orders go live today when the podcast comes out on Friday. So we'll link that up in our show notes as well if you do want to check it out. Now, I do love the fact that I'm able to talk about the Commodore Plus 4 on this podcast recently, which, you know, a little recap for people that don't know. My first computer growing up, got a Commodore Plus 4, really wanted a Commodore 64, which obviously was like, you know, what all the cool kids had. But the Plus 4, a big market failure. My mum kind of got one on a fire sale at Lasky's, I think it was, for like £99 with a load of games included. But I loved that machine growing up because it was my first computer. And there were some good games on there as well. But there was one game that I've got a vivid memory of this, going to a little computer shop called Chips that was a little branch of, like, I've got a feeling they're all around the country.
I remember Chips, yeah.
I mean, they were all over in kind of North Yorkshire and like Teesside and Darlington, that kind of area when I was a kid. And I remember going to the one in Redcar, or Redcar, as they say it there, which is like a seaside resort not far from Middlesbrough. And there's one just up there on the seafront. And I've got a vivid memory, hot summer's day. My dad used to drive us there on a Saturday. And we'd go and play in some of the arcades, you know, back in the late 80s, having fish and chips and then going into Chips, different Chips, to ask if they had any Commodore Plus 4 games, which was, I've told the story before, generally they'd always be a bit like, oh, hang on, we might have. Let me go check in the back. And they'd, you know, come back 20 minutes later with like a dusty box. Might have one or two games there as well. But actually the guy gave me a poster of Outrun, because around that time, this must have been like 88, 89, they were kind of releasing the home ports of Outrun around that time. And I put that up on my bedroom wall above my Commodore Plus 4. And I look at the screenshots on there, and I'd played the game in the arcade, and I remember kind of fantasizing how amazing it would be to be able to play Outrun at home, because obviously the Plus 4 was a failed platform, was discontinued, I think, in 1985, you know, years before I got hold of mine and years before, you know, the Outrun home ports came out. But it actually turns out all these years later, over what, like 35 years later, I can now finally play Outrun on my Commodore Plus 4.
I could tell you're really proud of that, and I think it's really cool as well, because wasn't Stunt Car Racer one that we covered recently?
I think there was a port that was ported.
Yeah, and that was a really impressive job. And looking at this looks great.
Well, Mike Daly, who, you know, obviously we've had him on the podcast several times, of Lemmings Frame DMA Design, he tagged me on Twitter the other day saying, you might like this, Dan. I looked at this and my jaw dropped. So essentially this is a homebrew port of Turbo Outrun for the Commodore Plus 4, which obviously was, you know, nothing that we got commercially back in the day at all. But I think this is, honestly, I couldn't believe this was running on the Plus 4 when I saw this video. Have you seen the screenshots and watched the video of this, Joe?
Yeah, I had to check it out because of when you posted it in our group chat yesterday and said, when I was a little boy and I used to look up at that poster and dream of being able to play it at home.
Look at that blonde lady in the car.
I thought that was so sweet, and I thought, right, I'm going to have to go check this out. And it looks pretty good, to be honest. Like, you know, like I say, I'm not familiar, you know, with the Plus 4, the Commodore Plus 4, so I'm not 100% sure, you know, of what its capabilities are and stuff like that. So
not very much.
Not very much, as you say. But it just, to me, like, you know, from the outside looking in, it looks like a very nice 8-bit game, especially, you know, the screenshot of America, you know, where you kind of get the, what, you know, the route you're going to drive.
The kind of map as well.
The map, yeah. That looks wonderfully colourful. You know, the colour palette on that looks fantastic. And I'm going to go ahead and assume that the Plus 4 probably didn't have the greatest colour palette for its actual.
Well, actually, bizarrely, it had more colours than the Commodore 64.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, all it right. did. It had, I think it was 121 colours. I've got a feeling there's something like maybe 8 shades of black or something were included in that. Okay. So that's kind of a meme that I see online sometimes. But in terms of, yeah, the graphic, the palette of it was actually a bit more advanced than the 64. But in terms of what it could do, I mean, basically, I've talked about this before, the Plus 4 was basically a CPU, a bit of RAM, and then one chip called the TED that basically did like the I/O, it did the graphics, it did the audio as well. So, I mean, you know, even the audio of it, nothing in the same ballpark as the legendary SID chip on the 64. But actually, you can check out the music that they've done on this as well.
Sounds banging.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's nowhere near as good as a SID chip, but I think in terms of, you've got to remember this, it's a very, very limited sound chip. And it's also, this chip is doing the I/O and the graphics at the same time. And you've got this music playing over the game, which I think is an incredible achievement. I think it's pretty fantastic.
That's grooving. I was dancing around.
I think this is a really nice little release. It's free on the website as well, which Plus 4 World. And also noticed looking at the screenshots. I thought this is quite nice. They've got the Cracker Group HCS on the intro. Oh, nice. So I think maybe they're kind of like having a bit of nostalgia of the old Cracking Group coming back, which is pretty cool.
Well, TCFS is the guy who's behind this this new port of it as well. There's Unreal, a guy called Unreal has done the graphics on this as well. I never know how to pronounce his name, but I always see it written down. C-Sabo, you know, C-S-A-B-O has done the soundtrack of this. Apologies for, if I pronounce your name wrong there. I always see his name written in forums and stuff as well. All 16 levels are in there. You've got the, you know, the special boost feature that allows you like a turbo boost and like speed up for a brief amount of time as well. And actually the guys who did the Lemmings ports to, you know, the Lemmings version for the Commodore Plus 4 that we covered, they did Empire Strikes Back as well for the Plus 4 recently as well. They're the guys up behind this too. So okay, I think the work that they're doing is just jaw-dropping.
I could just imagine Dan, like, printing out this screen with the guy, you know, sat in his car with the nice lady next to him and going to the hairdressers and being like, I want my hair like him.
Yeah, in my Ferrari. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say, I want my hair like her.
Gotta have a dream, Joe. Gotta have Brilliant. A dream. So, yeah, I mean, this just looks incredible. I love the fact that the Plus 4 scene is suddenly becoming so active and they're doing stuff that no one thought was possible. So, like you said, Joe, it is free to download. So I'll link that up in the show notes as well on their Plus 4 World. Now, we have got, we're going to be talking about possibly the most obscure flash cart that we've ever heard of in just a moment. And some more big news if you are an Atari fan in just a second. Before we do that, just a sec to say that we do have a little patron that supports this podcast. And thank you so much for all your support on there as well. We're going to be doing our first patrons hangout of 2024 next Sunday, which does mean that we're finally at the end of January.
I'm looking forward to that. And we're also doing an after hours episode where, you know, we're going to be playing games that we can't believe the other person hasn't played. So there's going to be some interesting reviews on those. And, you know, hopefully we'll get to experience some new titles.
Yeah, so if you want to join our patrons community, we always love welcoming in new people. You get an invite to the hangout that's coming up on Sunday 28th at 8 p.m. that night, 8 till 10 UK time we do that. Basically, it's like a massive Zoom call. Everyone gets together, we just nerd out, show off new pickups, that kind of thing. Have a bit of fun. So if you'd like to join us for that, we'd love to see you there. We have the After Hours podcast, which is for our gold members and above. If you join now, you'll unlock, I think it's 38 back episodes of that. That you can check all those episodes out, and a new episode of that will be landing at the end of the month. We try and get the normal podcast out early if I can. You get it ad-free every week, and also you get around 10 to 15 minutes of extra news stories just for our patrons on every episode as well. But obviously the main reason to support the podcast on Patreon is just to make sure that we can keep the lights on and keep bringing out this podcast and pay, you know, all our hosting fees and all that kind of thing are covered. So we hugely appreciate your support, and we like to induct new members into the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming. And that is the Retro Hour Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame.
And a massive thank you to our latest members. Thank you, Editor B.
Kate Pankhurst.
Pig Dam.
And Mark Devlin, who all joined our Patreon community in the last couple of weeks. We massively appreciate that. And if you'd like to join us, all the details are on the website right now at theretrohour.com. Now, you did say, Ravi, that, you know, it is a very exciting time to be an Atari fan. Seems like there's so much going on in the Atari sphere recently.
It's mad. There's so much choice there. It's like, which Atari do I get? It's pretty
crazy.
There's
a lot going on at the moment. And obviously, it's been CES recently as well over in Vegas. And this was actually pretty exciting. This is My Arcade. Now, we did talk about My Arcade a couple of years ago. They've done, you know, they did that kind of mini Atari Mega Player that was like that mini little arcade. They also did a console as well, didn't they? I think it was called the Game Station Remix. They had some classic Atari games in there too. And now they've basically got a nice little handheld way of playing classic Atari titles.
I think Ravi said this a couple of times. Atari seem to be making much better decisions right now with like their licensing deals.
Yeah.
And kind of like who they're licensing it out to and not coming up with. We mentioned earlier on the show's now 8 years old, but I remember it felt about 8 years ago where we were talking about the Atari casino hotels. They were on about doing that, I don't think ever.
They did go through a weird period a few years
ago. Yeah, they went through a really weird period.
Cryptocurrency.
Yeah, whereas it's nice to see they've taken a big step back at the moment and kind of rooting themselves in like the fans, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
I think that, I don't know, I think there's going to be, have to go into the kind of ST and the Jaguar area eventually.
Why not?
Because they've got, you know, so many of the classics coming out now. they might kind of flood their own market with the amount of stuff that's coming out.
This one is a bit different because this gives you a way to play classic Atari games, 2600 games on the go. And interestingly, I think this is the first time I've ever seen a handheld console that has a trackball built in. Yeah, admittedly, a very small
one. That's amazing. bring the trackball back. I absolutely love that as a controller. You know, I was playing Marble Madness the other day with a trackball, and it's just such a different experience of gaming.
Well, this system is called the Atari Game Station Portable. So tell us a bit about the specs of this, Joe. What can we expect?
The big reveal was the mini trackball on there, as well as a paddle controller, you know, the little dial controller, which we have seen before, you know, kind of like in modern iterations and stuff like that. But seeing them together on a handheld is really cool. It's got a 7-inch high resolution screen on there. And obviously it's portable, rechargeable battery, etc. Kind of the shape and size of it kind of reminds me, obviously it's going to be bigger than an iPhone, but the shape and look of it really remind me of an iPhone for some reason. Maybe it's just the shape there.
It's a bit like an Evercade to me, maybe. It reminds me a bit, you know, the handheld Evercades.
Yeah, maybe, from the back, because it's kind of got those like grips on the back of it that you can't really see from the front. But yeah, I think this is really cool. Portable 2600. Like you say, paddle control based on the CX-30 from you know, kind of like original Atari games in the arcade, and obviously the old trackballs.
It's got a dial on it as well, hasn't it?
That's the paddle that I was on about,
The paddle, yeah.
Good for Tempest and Pong. And,
I was just thinking of Tempest exactly when I saw that. I was like, that would be great, yeah.
Yeah.
One thing I'm reading about this is, it mentions that obviously you've got, you know, the usual stuff in there, like rechargeable battery, you know, 7-inch high resolution screen. All I've heard from the reports is it's got a load of pre-installed Atari classics on there as well. I've been trying to find a list. I'm not sure
whether anything is there.
Well, they had that Game Station Pro as well before the Atari one, which came out from my arcade, and that had, you know, 200 games on it. So, I think there might be a huge list coming out for this. And that was $100, $99.99.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure they will, you know, release a full list of it at some point as well, which, and again, the thing I'm wondering is basically, can you load your own games onto these?
I imagine you will be able to, whether they...
Maybe not officially.
is always the question. But, you know, it just says like, you know, it will be the trackball, will be compatible with such games as Centipede, Millipede, Missile Command, you know, and, you know, the paddle was used for Breakout and Canyon Bomber and stuff like that. So we'll see what games they do come out with, or if it's just this is the unit and then you go do what you want to do with it, because some of them are a little bit like that as well. But yeah, it looks pretty cool. No news on the price, as Ravi says, but imagine probably around the £100 mark they usually are.
They must have a huge timeline of what they're aiming for, and, you know, making sure all these are released at different times and stuff. It's really interesting to see this level of, you know, commitment to the old devices and the old legacy. You know, we've seen Sega doing stuff, but nothing to this level. Atari seem to be really, really pushing it at the moment.
And I've seen some people complain about that, like, how many more ways do we need to play Atari games? And I get that you can do it, you know, you can run... I mean, God, you can easily do this. You can run like Atari 2600 titles just on a television's firmware these days. You know, you've actually run more advanced games on your TV.
Yeah, they've had the Atari 50th collection as well. There's been tons of stuff.
But I don't think, you know, having more options is not a bad thing at all. I think, you know, again, like we said before, people want it, they'll buy it. If they don't, they won't.
Yeah,
but
if there's a market for it and they think that they'll actually sell it, you know,
I've got a feeling that might, you know, maybe people will get a bit kind of overwhelmed of, you know, might get a bit tiring sometimes to see the same old games coming out all the time. But I think, you know, you made an interesting point there. You know, I think it would be interesting to see Atari doing like a way to play ST games again, or
it's going to happen eventually, hasn't it? You know,
If they can do the A500 Mini, they could do an Atari ST Mini, or, you know, a Jaguar. I think there would be a market for it. You know, if they're doing stuff like licensing out the Atari 400, I know Joe would be the first in line to get an Atari Jaguar Mini.
I think they're going to run out of, you know, ways to repackage 2600 games in VCS.
I do agree. I think kind of, it's great that we've got so many options. It might be time to kind of start thinking about something else now. I do see your point. But if you're doing to play Atari 2600 games on the go, legally, officially Atari branded, then these are coming soon. So I'll shove that link in our show notes as well. Now, just one more thing to talk about before we hop into this week's very special guest, the Casio Loopy. Now, I think we do actually cover the Casio Loopy with Lewis Packwood. We're going to be talking about obscure systems in just a minute. And the Casio Loopy, we have talked about this before. This was a games console released by Casio, who are mainly known for calculators and watches. Came out in the mid-90s, October 1995. Interestingly, in Japan only, but it was marketed exclusively towards preteen girls. So that was the audience. I mean, there were, you might have seen videos on this. It came with a built-in thermal color printer. And the idea was that you'd be able to print out, you know, stickers that you'd, you know, put on your...
I would have loved that when I was younger, you know, a console that could print out stickers. Yeah, the Loopy's interesting. And, you know, it's a rare console. It's quite hard to get. And the games, I can imagine, are even harder.
Well, the games on it, I mean, that they're generally focused around things like fashion and dating and, you know, things that are kind of stereotypically associated with, you know, young girls in the mid-90s. But yeah, there wasn't many games came out for this at all.
11. There was 11 titles made for it, which it kind of leads on to this week's story about it, because of with there only being 11 games and it being a commercial failure, they've become very hard to kind of, you know, find on eBay, etc., attain. Which, you know, leads nicely into the, is it the Floopy Drive?
I love that name.
The Floopy Drive.
This is a Loopy. Yeah. This is the Floopy. A bit like, yeah. I read it as floppy at first, like a floppy drive. But no, it's
yeah, same.
Drive.
And I was like, wait, am I reading this wrong? Is it a floppy drive? Is it the Floopy Drive? But yeah, the Floopy Drive, that has been made by Roger Brunstein, who has created quite a few flash carts now. And this is going to only be $90 and an alternative way to emulate and play on your Loopy Drive if you've got one, Ravi.
I think this is great because this is like the exact use case for a kind of flash cart or EverDrive or, you know, one of these multi-cart things that you can put SD cards in and load it up with. It's probably going to spur on a bit of development, I think. And, you know, people can use it to test stuff that they've done, test code, and we might start seeing some more Loopy titles coming out in the future.
A Port of Doom, maybe, for the Loopy.
Yeah, someone's got to do that.
Print off your Doom stickers. There was also a video capture accessory called the Magical Shop for the Loopy as well. So, you know, maybe we could see some capture card for Doom on the Loopy, maybe.
Yeah, it's quite cool. It's also got a USB-C attached to it, so you can do data transfer like directly to it as well. And that might be really good for testing.
And yeah, I mean, that is one thing that does kind of open up the market to homebrew on it. You know, the fact that you can transfer files back and forth between it. It's only got 32 megs of flash memory on there, but like you said, with only 11 titles, probably doesn't need all that much more, if I'm honest. It's got a battery-backed SRAM on there for save game data as well. And this is kind of an indication of how niche this market is. He's actually only making, the first production run is going to be 15 units. But the good news is he's sold out already, apparently.
Oh,
so there's at least 15 Casio Loopy fans in the world.
I've just seen like the trailer, and I think that's a really good point in there that, you know, this system was released in Japan, but you can get translated versions of the games. So, you know, you can run the translated versions now. And that's really cool because it could open up the whole library for you.
I know you want one of these, Ravi, with a Floopy Drive in there and print out some stickers to put on your He-Man lunchbox.
I'm wearing a Casio watch at the moment.
There
man.
You go. Yeah, totally. Compliment it, won't it? So if you are one of the, I don't know how many listeners we've got with a Casio Loopy in their collection, if you have got one, let us know. That'll be exciting news for you, though, that there is a flash cart now for possibly one of the world's most obscure consoles, the Casio Loopy. But I'm sure we're going to get into even more obscure ones with our special guest, Lewis Packwood, who is the author of this new book, Curious Video Game Machines. Now, before we do that, I mean, here in the UK at the moment, oh my God, it's so cold, isn't it? I think today it was like -3. We're slowly getting about maybe...
It's definitely going to snow as we're recording this,
All these forecasters, you know, more bad weather coming and people talking about, you know, the fact they're always feeling a bit tired in January now. Christmas is out the way and we're into the new year and the weather's drab and still dark all the time. Maybe you need something to get you going a little bit. around this time of year. Well, let's take a moment to give a massive thank you to this week's sponsor. It is our wonderful friends at AG1. Now, this is something that has become part of my daily routine over the last couple of weeks because AG1 were kind enough to send us a free sample of this, which I know you and I have been testing this out, Ravi. It's really a way to think about, you know, changing the way that you think about your daily nutrition because, you know, I've tried vitamin tablets and stuff and iron supplements, never really affect me all that much. But this, you know, rather than having all those different tablets laid out every morning, this is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 high quality ingredients designed to support your physical and your mental health as well. I don't know if you found this, Ravi, the really simple thing about this is how easy it is to use as well. It's literally one scoop into a glass of water when you wake up in the morning. And basically you've got, you know, a powerful mix in there, all the vitamins you need, the minerals and the nutrients you need to keep your energy up and your mind sharp throughout the day.
Yeah, I've basically had it in my daily routine now and I've replaced coffee, which, you know, was usually my thing, wake up in the morning and have some coffee. But having this is a lot better as well because you don't get that caffeine kind of crash that you usually get with coffee. And, you know, you're also getting a lot of that like nutrient replenishment.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously this time of year, everyone I know has had flu or, you know, the C word, which you shouldn't mention for the algorithm, you know, or a bad cold. It's all going around at the moment as well. And actually it helps, you know, support your immune system as well. You know, vitamin C, zinc, other key ingredients in there as well that can help keep your immune system in top shape as well. So it's a really simple way to get everything you need and make it a really seamless part of your morning as well. Really simple daily habit, takes up less than a minute and will make a massive difference to how you feel as well. And it tastes gorgeous as well. So maybe your New Year's resolution was to kind of get a bit more in shape and, you know, get a bit healthier as well. If you're wondering about the quality of it, AG1 is actually NSF certified for sport, meaning it's gone through some rigorous testing and certification as well. So you can trust that what you're getting, what you see on the label is exactly what you're getting in there. Nothing more, nothing less. So if you want to try this out, a really convenient way, why don't you give AG1 a try? And of course, you know, we always get you some little bonuses for supporting our sponsors. So if you go to this website right now, drinkag1.com/retrohour, that is drink, letter A, letter G, number one.com/retrohour, you will get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and a 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase of AG1. So head to this website right now, drinkag1.com/retrohour, and check it out today. And a massive thank you to our friends at AG1 for their continued support of the podcast. Okay, next, going inside the world of obscure and weird and maybe some kind of consoles and computers you haven't heard of before, with the author of the new book, Curious Video Game Machines, Lewis Packwood, is next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. And now, our guest today is someone I'm sure you're familiar with from his work in the likes of Retro Gamer magazine, the wonderful website Time Extension. He also writes for Edge and The Guardian as well. And the reason we've got him on today is to talk about this incredible new book called Curious Video Game Machines, looking at some of the more obscure oddities from the world of video gaming history. So let's welcome on our guest this week, Lewis Packwood. How's it going, Lewis?
Hello. Yeah, good to be here. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, really excited about this new book.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, if you've ever heard the podcast before, you know, I kind of thrive on the weirder side of video game history. So, and I've been reading through your book, and it's got some incredible stuff I've never heard of before. That, as Ravi mentioned before we started recording, I will no doubt be looking for on eBay at the end of this interview today. So it might cost me a bit of money after this. But I mean, we also had to kind of find out a bit of a background on our guests as well, kind of their, you know, their roots in gaming. So just, you know, before we get into the book, what's kind of your background? Where did it all start for you, your interest in the gaming industry and games itself?
Yeah, well, I'm in my mid-40s now, and I kind of started gaming, we'll be back in the Spectrum days. So that was the first game I ever remember playing was Horace Goes Skiing on the ZX Spectrum. I think my dad owned a Spectrum. And then after that, I was really into the Amiga and had a 500, then a 1200, and then got a Game Boy and NES, Super NES, and then PlayStation, Dreamcast, and it just carried on from there. And I never really stopped playing video games. And obviously now my career revolves around them. I started becoming a freelance game journalist about 10 years ago now and gradually built it up until now. That's what I do full time. But before that, I was a scientific copy editor. So it was quite different.
Quite the change, yeah.
Quite a change.
Did you come across any strange machines and obscurities when you were a kid?
Well, I think now. I mean, there were all these ones that I kind of craved that I saw in magazines, you know, the PC Engine, these desirable things that you could only get in Japan or for ridiculous money on grey import. Vaguely remember some of the tabletop games. And I think, you know, there's that wonderful new book coming out about the tabletop handheld machines, like the Grandstand, Invaders from Space and all that kind of stuff. Mm. I remember those. We had a load of those knocking around when we were kids, the hand-me-downs from uncles and aunts and things like that. So, yeah, I remember those wonderful tabletop machines. But, yeah, apart from that, not so much. This book was more inspired by the kind of conversations I've had with people I've interviewed over the years. Mm. There's been, in particular, I spoke to Chris Crawford a couple of years ago for a feature on his game Balance of Power for Retro Game. So Chris Crawford, yes. he's quite a storied kind of gamer, game developer, I should say. I mean, he started off at Atari and then went off to form Imagic with a bunch of other people and coded Demon Attack, and then later did Balance of Power for the Mac, and then went on to form GDC, was one of the founders of GDC. So I was speaking to him about Balance of Power, this amazing kind of game he made for the Mac, where you kind of controlling one of the two superpowers and trying to prevent a nuclear war, essentially. And we were talking, he just kind of like, just casually mentioned this thing and was like, oh, do you want to hear about this thing called Kim Tactics? I was like, what's Kim Tactics? And he showed me some pictures of this amazing machine, this kind of big wooden contraption with a kind of plexiglass red lid and a couple of little controllers that looked like they were made out of calculators. And he was like, what's this? He says, oh, it's a war game machine I made in the 1970s. I was like, what? And I'd never heard of this thing before. And I don't think he really showed it to anyone. I think back in the 70s when he made it, he took it to a couple of war game conventions and people played on it. And it was all based on this kit computer called a Kim 1. It was one of the very first microcomputers that was available.
Commodore, I think, yeah.
Yeah, it was based on a MOS 6582 chip. So one of the first things to use that chip, and you built it yourself. And yes, we made this, and he decided to make this bespoke kind of game called Kim Tactics, and just took it around to conventions and showed people, and he would hang a curtain between the players so that they couldn't see what each other were doing. And it was all done in real time and all made controlled with these controllers with calculator parts. I thought, this is a fascinating story. I want to write this, but it's kind of an odd one. It's like not something that generally you kind of see in a publication like Edge or something like that. This is really odd story that doesn't really fit anything else. And it made me think of a few other odd stories I've written about down the lines, like the Galaxia Yugoslavian kind of kit computer and the Avatar machine that I'd written about. You know, the great Ben artist called Mark Owens. And I thought, well, yeah, there's loads of this stuff out here and no one's really talking about them. Let's write a book about
so. Yeah, it is a fascinating story, because we were lucky enough to have Chris on the podcast. I think it was episode 270, if people want to hear a bit more about Kim Tactics. And it was one of those stories where, you know, cause I'd like to think, having done this podcast for, like, you know, 8 years now, we kind of know a lot of kind of the mainstream history of gaming, but there is so much out there that just doesn't get documented enough, like you said. I mean, obviously, you've got, you know, Chris kind of started your idea then to write the book. How did you choose the other kind of specific machines and games to feature in here then? How did your journey kind of go along?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a process of elimination, partly. I mean, there were more ones I wanted to write about. There were a few things, I don't want to kind of spoil what they were, but there were a few things that I had to kind of ditch because I just couldn't find enough information on them. Mm. And that's the trouble, I think, you know, with these obscure machines, it's so hard to track down the people involved in making them or collecting them or even any information. I know there's one machine in here, the Interton VC4000, and I contacted the German computer museum and they said, oh, well, we've basically got nothing on this, you know. But luckily there are kind of collectors out there who do kind of collect these things and are able to kind of provide a bit more information. And the German computer museum did actually point me in the direction of some really useful articles that I found down the line. But the other ones that I've kind of chosen, that, I mean, you know, as you said, like, it's interesting to talk about the obscure, the weird things. And one of the things that really ignited my interest was when reading the replay, The History of Video Games by Tristan Donovan, which I have to say is one of the best books out there on the history of games. It's fascinating. It's really, really good. I highly recommend it. But there's just one sentence, I think, which just says, talking about Dragon's Lair, and then it says, oh, and Rick Dyer went on to create the Laserdisc-based Halcyon console. And then that was it. And I was like, what? I've never heard of this console. And it's that little thing, you know, these things are relegated to footnotes, and I wanted to kind of explore them a bit more and find out a bit more, because there's nothing out there about most of these machines.
It's very interesting because, you know, the popular machines are kind of dominant, but there's all these great stories that you're exploring about, you know, other obscurities. And one comes from Atari as well, which was the home Pong and video music as well, which I've not really heard of. How did that help shape the video game industry?
Yeah, so there's a whole, the second chapter is all about these Atari consoles, you know, and I don't know about you, but I'm familiar with like the Atari 2600 and the kind of later things that Atari made, but the home Pong and the earlier consoles, the dedicated consoles they made, i.e. they played one game and that was it. Then you had to buy a new console if you wanted a new game. They didn't really make it over to the UK. We did get some Pong machines in the form of like the Binatone things, but they didn't really kind of come over here. And one machine in particular, really, I was amazed, kind of, I saw a picture of it and I was like, what on earth is that? And that is Stunt Cycle, which is on the cover of the book as well. You'll see it's just a little thing with two handles. It's like a motorbike handles. And that came out in like 1977, I think it was. And it just played one game called Stunt Cycle. There were like four variations, but it was essentially one game. It was based on a Atari coin-op from 1975, I think it was, or 74. And you just pull down on the throttle and you have this little Evel Knievel type kind of stunt rider and he jumps over some buses, and that's pretty much the whole game. It's pretty simple. But just seeing this weird little machine, like I'd never seen it before. And then that made me think, right, well, what other weird things has Atari put out? And then discovering the video music, which is so rare and so obscure. And it was absolute flop when it came out. It's essentially a visual synthesizer, like a light synthesizer. Mm. The idea is you plug it into your hi-fi and then it outputs lights in time with the music. And they're kind of like these triangles that flash and grow and shrink in time with the music. But it was ridiculously expensive. It was the equivalent of about $200 in 1977, which is about $1,000 now.
Yeah.
And all it did was just make some flashing lights on the screen. So obviously it didn't do very well and was soon discounted and lost to history, really. But now that means it's incredibly rare. And I was really lucky enough to find a collector who had one, was able to take some photos and give me some more information about it, which is Control Alt Reese, who you may have may know of already. He's got a YouTube channel.
You know Reese.
We know, you know Reese. So yeah, he was really helpful in kind of putting that bit together. But it was fascinating. And the brilliant thing about writing this book is that the more research you do, the more stuff comes up. And it was just a journey of discovery. And in fact, in writing this book, there's like 18 chapters in there that I have enough information on new consoles that I'd never heard of and new computers to fill another book easily.
Volume two on the way.
I would love to do a follow-up. I'm hoping that if this one sells well enough, then I'll be able to get the green light to do a follow-up, because I've got so many more stories I want to tell.
Oh, that needs to happen. I mean, just even looking through, I mean, you mentioned like obviously those kind of early experiments by Atari, and kind of looking over at kind of what was happening in Europe as well. I mean, there was these systems that you mentioned in the book that I'd never heard of before, the German Interton consoles. So tell us a bit about those and how they kind of contributed to the early console race over here in Europe.
Yeah, the Interton VC4000 is a really obscure console that I only found out about when I was interviewing someone else, a collector, about the Halcyon, the RDO Halcyon that I mentioned earlier, the Laserdisc console. And he just casually said, oh, have you heard of the Interton VC4000? I was like, no. And then he just brings out this thing on this video call, and I was like, what on earth is that? And it's this console that was made by a hearing aid company. Interton's a hearing aid company. And somehow they decided to get into video games. And they started with some Pong consoles. They licensed the technology for the Magnavox Odyssey, the first games console, and they produced their own version of the Odyssey, which is kind of a weird hybrid machine called the Interton 2000. And it used cartridges, but those cartridges were just analog, essentially. It was a very odd machine. And then they released a few follow-ups to that, and then eventually the Interton VC4000 in 1978. which lasted for about 4 years, till about 1982, and then Interton kind of decided to go back to hearing aids, which is still what they're doing now. But yeah, it was a really odd one. It was quite popular in Germany, and it was sold in a few other countries in Europe. I don't think it was sold in the UK, or at least I've not found any evidence that it was. But it was fairly popular. Nowhere near as popular as the Atari, which I think sold quite well in Germany particularly, not so much in the UK. But what an odd thing. And it was based on this weird chip, this Philips Signetics chip, which hardly any other machines use. But then there was this whole crop of other consoles that use this same chip, and bizarrely a load of the same games are on these consoles and on the Interton. I managed to track down someone who ran the manufacturing plant in Hong Kong for Radofin, and he explained that actually Philips provided them a load of games along with the chip, so that explains partly at least why all these machines have the same games on them, because it was actually Philips making the games.
Well, interestingly, you cover the fact that, you know, Germany was split back then, and there was a you know, an East German machine as well that kind of came out of the Soviet Union. So it's interesting to see the kind of two parallels of those devices.
Yeah, the BSS-01. Yeah, the East Germany's one and only kind of console. It was some point, I think it was in the late 1970s, about 1979, that the kind of higher-ups in Germany, East Germany, I should say, decided that Germany needed a console, and they were going to put all of the state apparatus towards making one, and they manufactured this thing. But it was ridiculously expensive for considering how much people earned in the country at the time. And I think it only ever really found use in like youth centres and things. And then a couple of years later, they decided to stop producing it, and that was the end. But yeah, it was an odd little thing. Interestingly, it used a chip that was manufactured by GI, General Instrument, which I'm not quite sure how they managed to get it considering there were kind of import bans at the time on things like technology and microchips like that. But so there's still more to be told, I think, about that console. Still a few mysteries surrounding it.
We also mentioned you cover portable systems in here as well. And one that I found quite interesting was a story of the MB Microvision. I mean, kind of what was groundbreaking about that system, like in the context of, you know, portable gaming?
Yeah, that was fascinating. It was about 10 years before the Game Boy was released. And it's essentially the first portable console with interchangeable cartridges, which no one had really done before. But it was an odd beast. I say it's got interchangeable cartridges, but really you just snap off the entire front of the machine and then plug in another front of the machine for a different game. All that's on the actual base unit is just a screen and like a kind of pad, a sensitive pad for which the buttons lay on top of, and the buttons in themselves are actually on the cartridges. Really odd thing. But it was designed by Jay Smith, who went on to do the Vectrex, which is much better known, I think, at least in collector circles, the first vector-based console.
Yeah, especially with the Milton Bradley connection.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And I think he wanted to do a follow-up to the Microvision. The original was a very basic kind of LCD screen, one of the very first LCD screens. So it's only, I think, 16 pixels wide or something like that. It's very, very, very basic. But he had plans of doing a colour version. He wanted to do a follow-up. But then MB decided to pull the plug on it. But he ended up doing the Vectrex instead. But yeah, it's a fascinating thing. It's giant. It's, considering it's portable, it's absolutely huge. And I think when I was doing my research, I found that MB actually decided they wanted it to be big, according to Jay. I presumably with the idea that the bigger it is, the more expensive it seems. Whereas, really, they could have made it a lot smaller. There's no reason it has to be that big. Yeah, but it did go on to influence Nintendo. And I know that I think it's Satoru Iwata. I'm probably saying his name wrong there. He was a big fan of Brickbuster on the Microvision and said it was one of his favorite games.
Yeah, I find it really interesting that it had a kind of interchangeable front because, you know, you've got all the different button combinations and stuff. And, you know, later on, stuff like the Atari Jaguar controller had kind of overlays that you put on, but this one you'd put on top and it would give you the right buttons for each title.
Yeah, although most of them didn't really use the buttons. I think there's only one title that actually uses all of them. I mean, you can have 12 buttons on the screen. I think most of them only use one or two. But yeah, it was quite an interesting idea, the idea that it was an adaptable controller. You can use whichever buttons you see fit for each game. I think there were some differences between the US and the European versions. I think the US version, they just had a thin film on the actual cartridge, and you kind of like pushed your finger down onto this film and then through onto the buttons that were hidden underneath. And then they quickly realized, I think people were just tearing through this film with their fingernails. So when they released it in Europe, it instead came with like little hard plastic buttons that went over the top.
Yeah, kind of go back to Atari as well. I mean, something I found very interesting in the book was kind of the idea, you know, Atari's VCS dev kit, how that kind of challenged Atari's own market dominance. What kind of happened there from your research?
Yeah, so it's an odd thing, isn't it? Thinking back now, like now we're so used to third-party developers and you know, how important they are for the success of the console. But, you know, back in the 1970s, you know, Atari wanted it all for themselves. No one really did that. You know, if you produced a console, your company made all of the games for it. And so it was quite pioneering that David Crane and Larry Kaplan and the others who formed Activision, they left Atari and they had to come up with a way of making games for the Atari. And I spoke to kind of David Crane over email and like asked him about how exactly they went about doing this. And he very casually said, oh, we just got this computer and we plugged it into this and did all this. And I was like, wow. And he explained how he made what they called the Blue Box, which was the first development kit. Because how do you get games onto a console? You know, when you think about it, there has to be a way to move the code from your computer actually onto the cartridge. And they kind of came up with a way of doing that. And then, of course, once they'd figured it out, then loads of other people managed to work it out independently. And Gary Kitchen, who went on to create Donkey Kong for the ColecoVision and the Atari, he kind of worked out independently how to code, make a development kit for the Atari 2600. And then, it wasn't just him. Loads of people started doing it. And it was it's fascinating to see everyone kind of independently working out how to do this. It's not obvious. Right. You know, you have to have quite a bit of knowledge to try and essentially backwards engineer the console and try and work out how it works and then plug it into an Apple II or whatever you need to use to actually make it work. So I was kind of like fascinated by that and how people did that when such a thing like a development kit just didn't exist. You know, there was no need to have one because there were no consoles before that.
Yeah, it's just remarkable as well that Atari were, you know, so against it too. Because like you said today, it's just such a given part of the industry. You know, console couldn't survive without third-party development. And obviously, that kind of, you know, Activision spun out of Atari for that very reason, that they just wanted to keep it all for themselves.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's right. And, and you know, Atari sued Activision in 1980, yeah. I think it was, you know, trying to stop them, get them out of business, even though they were releasing games that were huge hits and undoubtedly helped to sell the Atari. You know, Pitfall, for example, you know, it's like one of the top five selling games, I think, ever on the Atari. And then eventually in 1982, the court ruled that essentially legitimized third party and said, you know, Activision's fine to carry on doing this, but they have to pay royalties to Atari. And that model is now kind of entrenched throughout, you know, the games industry. People can make games for whatever machine they want, but they have to pay a royalty.
Yeah, exactly. We're kind of going through the book as well. I mean, just, you know, to touch on another few, you know, systems that people might not be familiar with, and I certainly wasn't. I find it interesting as well in that kind of pre-internet era, how many different machines were localized to a certain region as well. And one that seemed quite significant as well is from Yugoslavia, an open source computer. Tell us a bit about this one. This is quite significant.
Yeah, that's right. I love the Galaxia. Yeah, the Galaxia is named after a science magazine that was kind of published the original plans to make one. And it was by this guy called Voya Antonish. He's a wonderful man. He lives in California now. He moved there a few years ago. And he's one of the kind of unsung heroes, I think, of the computer world, because he was grappling with this problem in the early 1980s. Yugoslavia was essentially a communist state, although it wasn't allied with the Soviet Union at the time, semi-independent state. But it had some very strict laws about imports. You couldn't import anything above the value of about 50 Deutschmarks, which meant that no one could import computers. No one could import Spectrums or C64s because they were too expensive. So they either had to resort to smuggling, or Antonich kind of realized maybe there was a way to create their own computer from parts that they could afford, you know, could get around the smuggling, could get around the import laws. So he came up with the idea for this Galaxy. It's a very kind of underpowered computer. If you could, based essentially less powerful than a Spectrum, but he came up with the plans, got together with the editor of the Science magazine, and they published a special issue showing people how to make their own computer and using parts that could be easily kind of sourced and wouldn't fall afoul of the laws. And it was really popular. Thousands of people made their own Galaxias, and kind of uniquely, they didn't kind of include instructions on how to make a case. I mean, there was some kind of like guide, or maybe you can use a bit of circuit board, you can cut up, you know, make a case. But most people just went to town and made their own cases. So there were Galaxias out there that were covered in wood or metal, or some that are just completely left naked. So I love this idea that, you know, there's no standard look to one of these machines. You know, they all look completely unique and individual.
Yeah, that's I mean, it's kind of a bit like the Raspberry Pi today, isn't it? I suppose everyone's got their own different cases on them a bit, yeah.
It is. It's just like that. And it was fairly short-lived. I mean, after the Galaxia came out, they actually changed the law, I think, the year after it came out, after the magazine was published with the instructions on how to make one. And then everyone started importing the Spectrums and things like that. So it didn't last a long time, but it was very influential. It got a lot of people into coding or interested in computing. Mm. And I think Antonish thinks that actually it was the law was changed because of the Galaxia. You know, it might have been one of the things that really, really nudged things forward. We can never know for sure, but it certainly seems unlikely to be a coincidence.
How did the Enterprise console in 1985 change the video gaming industry?
Well, I don't think it really changed the video gaming industry in the UK very much. It was very much one of those things that arrived and then disappeared almost as quickly. But it changed games industry in Hungary. I love this story. I was fascinated by the Enterprise because, for a start, it's a brilliant looking computer. It looks gorgeous. If you've ever seen a picture of the Enterprise,
yeah, I've just Googled
64
it
or 128, it's got this amazing little built-in joystick, which I don't think I've ever seen before on a computer, certainly not a UK computer anyway. So it's a wonderful little thing, and it's got these beautiful colour keys as well. Interestingly, something it shares with the Amstrad CPC. Yeah, the Enterprise was actually revealed, the promo was actually revealed, I think, back in 1983 or early 1984, and then the CPC didn't come along till about a year later. So some people kind of suggesting maybe someone copied the coloured keys. We'll never know for sure.
The whole colour scheme of the device looks very similar to the Amstrad, doesn't it?
It does look very
similar.
Yeah, the
black casing and,
it does look very similar. I did tweet Alan Sugar to ask whether it was a coincidence. He didn't reply, so we'll... But maybe if you ever get him on the show to interview, you could ask him.
First question.
But that was the trouble. The Enterprise, it was too long in the oven, really. And it was announced in, I think it was early 83. And the specs looked amazing. But then it didn't come out until 1985, by which point the Amstrad CPC and a load of other computers had come out and essentially undercut it. And by the time it actually came out, it was a bit of a white elephant, really. So it was mostly down to trying to sort out its kind of custom graphics and sound chips. That seems to be the thing that really held it up in development.
But Z80 based as well, like the Amstrad, which is very interesting.
Exactly, yeah, that's right. But it did have an unlikely afterlife in Hungary. It ended up being the third most popular micro over there, according to some of the Enterprise fans I spoke to. And it had a really lasting impact in that country. And even now, there's still a magazine dedicated to the Enterprise that's still being produced by Enterprise fans called Enterpress. And there's also stories of it being sold to be used in schools in Kazakhstan. I know that in Egypt it was fairly popular as well, made as a business machine. So it's fascinating. You know, things that essentially were flops here has just gone on to kind of have another life somewhere else, you know. And I think that's part of the thing I really wanted to talk about in the book. Like, everywhere's different, you know. We hear this narrative of the definitive history of the games industry, but quite often it's US centric or Japan centric, and actually every country had a completely different experience, you know. I think in Korea as well, I talk about Korea, about what was going on over there, and that was completely different, absolutely unlike anywhere else in the world.
Well, one thing, you know, today obviously we take for granted that, you know, gaming's for everyone. But one thing you touch on the book is obviously, I mean, back in the 80s, it did definitely seem like it was a bit more of a boys thing stereotypically. And you talk about the impact of games consoles that were actually targeted specifically at female gamers in the 80s and somewhat the 90s as well. I mean, any examples of those that kind of spring to mind that you've researched in the book?
Yeah, I mean, the most wonderful looking one is, and wonderfully named as well, is the Super Cassette Vision Ladies, which comes in a pink briefcase and comes with a game called Milky Princess, which has got to be one of the most uniquely named games I've ever heard. It does sound very wrong. It was basically a horoscope game. Had the kind of equivalent of Russell Grand or Mystic Meg endorsing it. It was René Vandal, who was like an astrologer in Japan at the time. There's nothing really to the game. You essentially put in your date of birth and answer a couple of questions, and then it gives you a horoscope. And then there's a little kind of basic kind of platformy thing as well. But it's weird. Yeah, there's been a few attempts to make consoles aimed at girls. So the Super Cassette Vision Ladies was a kind of pink version of the Super Cassette Vision, which was a console released by Epoch, who also did Sylvanian Families, interestingly. But Epoch were the market leader before the Famicom came along. The Cassette Vision, the original Cassette Vision, was one of the biggest selling consoles in Japan before the Famicom arrived. And the Super Cassette Vision never really replicated that success. But they did release this one-off version in 1985, the Super Cassette Vision Ladies. So difficult to say.
Yeah, doesn't roll off the tongue, that name, does it?
It doesn't roll off the tongue. But I don't think it did particularly well. And it's very hard to come by now. Like, I know I've spoken to collectors who've been searching for one for years, and they really very rarely come up for sale.
Yeah, and then I know there's a Casio Loopy as well in Japan, like about a decade later that they tried, another kind of female-orientated system.
Yeah, the Casio Loopy, that was a console that printed stickers. It came out around the same time as the PlayStation. But it was kind of pretty underpowered compared to the PlayStation. It was very much more based around the Super NES, but then had this amazing kind of sticker printing bit stuck on the side of it. Interesting, I spoke to some of the engineers who designed the Loopy, and they said that it was never originally meant to be for girls. That was just something that marketing came up halfway through development and said, oh, we're going to target this to girls, just so you know. But yeah, it was an interesting idea. And it, weirdly, sticker printing did catch on in a big way in Japan a few years later with the Purikura machines, which are essentially like glorified photo booths that printed out stickers that you could photographs of you. And on paper, the Loopy was capable of doing that. It had this little peripheral that you attach a digital camera, so you could essentially turn it into a Purikura machine and print out stickers of photos with all alterations made on top. But yeah, it never really caught on, which is a shame.
I love as well, like, you know, you think back to the 90s, I remember stuff, you know, like Philips entering the market briefly with the CDI, and obviously with you know, Sony, who were previously many known as an electronics company. One that I don't read about too much in the gaming sphere, I think they manufactured my dishwasher. Daewoo, I think you pronounce their name. They did their own console, didn't they? The Zemix console.
That's right, yeah, Daewoo. Daewoo, so Daewoo is one of these.
Daewoo, right, yeah.
That's it, Daewoo. I mean, probably in the UK, most people just know them, if they know them at all, for manufacturing cars. And that you might see the odd electronic product as well. They actually went out of business a few years ago, but then bits of it were the bits of the business were bought and carried on. So I think Daewoo Shipbuilding's still going. But it's like all these companies, like these Korean conglomerates, like Samsung, and we know, might know them for washing machines and air conditioners and things like that. But actually, they're doing everything from theme parks to ships to building buses to everything. So Daewoo, in that respect, wasn't really unusual in the sense that it was getting into home electronics. And it started off making computers in the kind of early 80s, kind of late 70s. They were based around the MSX standard.
Right.
Which, I don't know if you, have you talked about the MSX standard on the podcast before?
Yeah, we had an episode with remember Van Victorp? I believe he passed away a few years ago, but he came on and did an MSX episode with us. You know, fascinating story there, and obviously something that wasn't that big over here, but definitely gained some traction in certain parts of the world.
That's right, yeah. I think it was quite big in the Netherlands and South America, and certainly in Japan. So this idea of doing a standard for computers, a bit like the PC, essentially, would do a few years later.
And I love the look of the Zemix as well. It looks insane.
Oh, yes.
It's either looks like a VR system or a helmet from a cyborg or a kind of portable early CD player as well.
I've got to say, I genuinely think that the Zemix line of consoles are the most beautiful consoles ever made. They are gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. There were about five of them altogether. There was the original Zemix, which came in a couple of different colours, and it was kind of very chunky and plasticky kind of beautifully made. And there was a pink version. And then the ZEMX V, which I think is the one that's at the front of the chapter in my book, which is this rocket-shaped red thing with like black bits down the side. And it just looks fantastic. And there's even brilliant asymmetrically coloured one where it's kind of blue on one side and yellow on the other. It just looks gorgeous.
Do you remember the Viewmaster toys in the 80s? It looks a bit like one of those, yes. The shape of it, doesn't it? Yeah. Especially the
record. But also the kind of design of sports cars at the time.
Definitely, yeah.
Kind of emulating
that. That's it. Yeah. And then the Swansong was this console. The last ZEMX one they made looked like the Starship Enterprise. It had this little kind of bit raised up the top in the shape of a disc. It was just the most crazy design of a console you've ever seen. It was wonderful things. So I'd urge you to kind of look up the ZEMX console because they're beautiful things. And they were never sold outside Korea. We never saw them outside of Korea. And then the console market in Korea completely died in the 90s and was the only thing that lived on was PCs. And now it's predominantly kind of a PC-based kind of gaming industry in Korea. But yeah, this brief period in the 1980s, ZEMX console ruled.
I was wondering, what are the implications of the continued popularity of Famiclones?
Yeah, well, I spoke to a PhD researcher, Ian Larson, who's been looking into this. And I think the fascinating thing about Famiclones, which are clones of the Nintendo Famicom, is that for most countries, maybe not most, but certainly a good proportion of countries, they were the only experience they had of video games. You know, there were places in Africa or Eastern Europe or that didn't actually have the official versions of these machines. You know, the NES was never released in these territories and they never got a Mega Drive or anything like that. The only consoles they had access to were these bootlegs, these clones. So for many people, they were just as legitimate as like an NES in this country or whatever machine. So there's a real nostalgic kind of tie to them. And I think they're very rarely talked about or celebrated because of their kind of shady legality. You know, they're obviously produced without license, but they are tied indelibly to people's childhoods. And people, you know, like in Poland, talk fondly about Pegasus. You know, that was like one of the major ones over there, and that was the same as us talking about growing up playing the ZX Spectrum or the C64 or anything like that. So I really wanted to kind of talk about them, and it's interesting as well, in Russia, the Dendy almost became the official console over there. Nintendo actually endorsed the Dendy, this Famiclone, this clone of the, and they kind of struck a deal. Nintendo of America struck a deal with the people who made the Dendy, saying that, okay, we'll turn a blind eye to this. You can carry on selling the Dendy, which had its own shops and a TV channel as well, you know, or a TV show. You know, it was advertised on TV and it was, you know, had all these official kind of shops that were selling the Dendy. And they said, okay, we'll turn a blind eye to this, but you have to sell the Super NES. That was the deal. And they did, but then I don't think the Super NES really took off over there because it was something like three times more expensive than the Dendy.
Yeah, people still buying the Dendy.
Exactly, yeah. So yeah, but it's fascinating to kind of see these parallel histories. You know, we there is no one history of video games. There's lots of different histories of video games according to which country you're in. Who you speak to.
One thing that was quite innovative, because obviously we saw kind of, you know, these kind of trends that came and went, and you touched on this in the book, VHS-based video games. For example, Action Max. So they were like an early attempt at like an interactive gaming experience, I guess, then, you know, using your standard video player.
That's right, yeah. I mean, when you think about the idea of playing a VHS-based console, it just seems like a crazy idea. But then you start to think about it, and then you go, well, actually, I suppose, you know, we had games on, you know, audio tapes, magnetic tapes when we were kids. You know, we were loading things on the Spectrum. So why not VHS tapes? Mm. But then the way it was kind of done, it was essentially you would play the tape and then there'd be some graphics overlaid on top. And most of the games that ended up coming out for these things were like shooting stuff. So you'd shoot things on the screen and the gun would register whether you'd hit it or not according to the flashing that it picked up on the object. So if it was flashing a certain way, it was registered as a hit. It's as simple as that, really. Nothing had changed on screen. That's the thing. The game still played out. It's just basically watching a 15-minute movie. Mm. The Action Max was one of the first ones. That was created by Worlds of Wonder, which is the same company that did Teddy Ruxpin and Laser Tag. Right. And it was formed by an ex-Atari guy who also they also got the deal to distribute the NES in the US. So for a while, they were really riding high, and then it all came crashing down a few years later in about end of 1987. There was a stock market crash, and yeah, it didn't end well for them. Yeah, for those few brief years in the middle of the 80s, they could do no wrong.
Isn't it? Night Trap was meant to be a VHS game originally, I heard, as well.
Well, they had an atmosphere, didn't they? And a few of those kind of board games, but not kind of interactive like this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I spoke to Rob Fullard, who he worked on Night Trap for the Sega CD. Although it wasn't originally made for the Sega CD, it was made for this console that was originally kind of being underwritten by Hasbro. And it was a Control VHS Vision. Console, yeah. The Control Vision. Yeah, that's right. And so the idea would be that it would divide the tape into four segments, essentially. So it would read half of the frames. It's difficult to describe it, but essentially it would halve the number of lines on the screen. So half of the lines were dedicated to one frame, and the half of the lines were dedicated to another frame, and it could interpolate between them so that you could choose between different cameras in the game. So you could follow one person and then follow the other. But of course, doing that meant that you had half the resolution. So it would really kind of take a hit on the resolution and the frame rate as well, because it's a bit difficult to describe. But the idea kind of would have worked in practice. But when I spoke to Rob, he was saying it was so hard to kind of get it to actually work. And VHS was very unreliable. You know, it's not like working with something like a Laserdisc or a CD player. But then Night Trap did end up being released on the Sega CD years later. But yeah, it was fascinating to hear about the making of Night Trap. You know, Rob was saying it was inspired by these interactive plays that he watched, where you would follow, I think Punch Drunk do these interactive theatre things now, but it was going on back in the 80s, and that was what inspired him to do this game where you follow different people around different rooms and switch between cameras. Other things would carry on happening whilst you were kind of like looking somewhere else. So yeah, it was really interesting to hear about that.
Well, one thing that fascinated me and has always kind of captured my imagination is the barcode battler. I remember seeing adverts for that and thinking, you know, nothing can make shopping with mum fun, and this might do it. What's the kind of story behind the barcode battler?
Yeah, I think if you've heard of the barcode battler, you probably remember it as like being this huge flop in the UK. It was released not too long after the Game Boy. A couple of years afterwards, you know, and you might have seen it in the Argos catalogue, and it wasn't that much cheaper than a Game Boy. I think it was about half the price, maybe, or just a bit over half the price. The idea being that you would scan in barcodes. It came with a few cards with kind of barcodes on them, and each of them had a picture of a warrior or a healing potion or things like that. But you could also grab the barcode from anything, like a packet of cornflakes, and scan it in and just see what it did. And the idea would be to kind of try and find the most powerful barcodes, and then you could battle the enemies that are kind of built into the game, or you could battle your friends. And all it did was the barcode would generate stats for attack, defense, special powers, that kind of stuff. It was pretty simplistic. You know, it was essentially you had a screen with just numbers. That was all it is. But it did come with some lovely artwork. And it was a massive flop over here. But in Japan, it was huge. For a couple of years, it was massive. They released two machines, the Barcode Battler and then the Barcode Battler 2. And the Barcode Battler 2 is actually the one that we got in the UK that's the Barcode Battler, just known as the Barcode Battler over here. And then they released a couple more. There was Barcode Battler 2CO, I think it was, and another couple, and then a football-based one. It went on for quite a while. And it even got featured on like primetime TV. There was a game show where they converted the Barcode Battler to run on a TV with one of those handheld scanners, and contestants would kind of run to this mock supermarket and grab things off the shelf and try and scan them to try and get the highest score. And, you know,
like a high-tech version of Supermarket Sweep.
It was just like that. It was just like that. So yeah, it was big. You can see how it kind of, it was a precursor to the Pokemon craze that happened a few years later. Right. You know, 'cause there were,
yeah, I was going to say with Pokemon, but also I do remember some, maybe a later version of Tamagotchis had some kind of barcode integration as well.
Yeah, I think the idea got recycled a few times, you know, and even especially when smartphones came along and people could use their cameras to scan things. So there was a kind of mini revival of barcode games around that time. If you search for barcode games on your phone now,
QR code.
Yes.
QR code battle.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah. So the idea is still, you know, it keeps coming up every now and then.
Well, one thing I love to see in the book was, you know, when you get into the 90s as well, and this is a memory that's still, you know, seared in my brain, when we had a family, we used to go every summer to Scarborough up in Yorkshire, and I remember going to an arcade and seeing Sega's Time Traveller for the first time. And you talk about that in the book as well, the fact that, you know, that was kind of, it was the first ever holographic game that I saw. But what was kind of the significance of that game then from your research?
Yeah, it's a fascinating kind of failed experiment, essentially. The Time Traveller, it was this enormous machine. If you've ever seen one in the flesh, imagine it's almost, the depth of it is almost as big as a pinball table. Like, that's how deep it is. And it's similarly kind of wide. It's a giant thing. It's like an enormous kind of twin-tub washing machine. But the idea is that you peer down into it and it's got this kind of curved mirror underneath and a TV kind of at your feet that's kind of reflecting off this mirror. And there's live-action characters, and they've each got these kind of like coded reflections. And when it's reflected off the screen, it looks like the figures are actually just floating on top of a piece of glass in front of you. It's a really remarkable effect. It works incredibly well as long as you keep your head still. If you tilt your head to one side or the other, the illusion is immediately ruined. But if you kind of keep your head in one position and look, it looks amazing. Unfortunately, the gameplay is very simplistic. It's one of those kind of QTE games where you just have to press in a certain direction or press a certain button at an exact time. And the only way to kind of learn it is by repetition. You just play it again and again. And it was expensive because it was such an expensive machine to produce. It actually cost a few quid to play usually. So I don't think it was ever going to be a real long-term money spinner. And then, of course, Street Fighter 2 came out in the arcade and no one cared about this weird machine anymore. But remarkable, weird thing.
And it's interesting because it's one of those experiences that, you know, you can't really watch it on YouTube. You can't, you know, it doesn't have the same effect. You can't emulate it. It's one of those where you really have to see the original machine to get the effect of it, you know, to realise how impressive it was.
There was a home version. So you can find a DVD version of this. But, of course, it doesn't really replicate the experience of seeing these little people floating around in front of you at all.
Well, enough, we're talking about kind of impressive, you know, somewhat novelty experiences from that era. Obviously, virtual reality is something that the industry, you know, to me, virtual reality is a bit like 3D TV. Something the industry churned out every maybe 10, 15 years to try and make it happen again. But obviously, in the early 90s, I mean, that was, again, another arcade experience I remember, using those virtuality machines that, you know, briefly popped up everywhere. But why do you think the virtuality machines didn't quite take off and that kind of, those early attempts at virtual reality struggled?
I think the simple answer is it was just too expensive. It was so expensive. I spoke to Robert Holmes, who was one of the founders of Virtuality for the book. And, you know, he was saying it was costing them thousands and thousands of dollars to kind of buy the technology that was used in these machines. The Virtuality, the original ones, used this magnetic tracking technology. Nowadays, Virtuality mostly uses accelerometers and things like that, but the same kind of things that you find in your mobile phone. But back then, they used this system using magnetic tracking. And the only people that were making that kind of stuff were people who were producing stuff for the military. You know, that was kind of how... And so they were having to go to these contractors that were used to working with the military, and the actual machines themselves, the kind of virtuality arcade machines, I mean, they cost anywhere from like $20,000 to $35,000 to produce. The exact figures are a bit vague because they negotiated prices per kind of vendor. So there was no kind of set price for these machines, but they were certainly tens of thousands of pounds. So, of course, they had to charge, you know, maybe £5 a pop or something to run them. And then quite often they would have to have an attendant to help you get in and out. And suddenly that's not a very economical way of running an arcade if you're having to, you know, charge people £5 a go and have someone constantly on hand to help people in and out of the arcade.
Full-time member of staff for one machine, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, we had in Nottingham, one of the only virtuality kind of arenas, which was called Legend Quest.
Oh, yeah.
I remember nobody went because it was very expensive and it was all kind of fantasy-themed and stuff. But, I think it was one of those things that people tried for a bit and then just kind of gave up on it.
I think it's one of those things where it was just too far ahead of its time, though. because the idea is sound, and it caused a lot of excitement at the time. But it was just the expense. It was too expensive. Perhaps if they'd been able to kind of accelerate it a bit more, if it was maybe a bit more popular at the time, there would have been a way to get costs down more quickly. And if there'd been a home version that worked well, then we might have seen a more advancement in the VR field. We might be further ahead than we are today, but still think, you know, virtual reality belongs in the arcade. We've seen quite a few virtual reality arcades pop up in the last few years that are doing pretty well. So this kind of, it feels like its natural home is somewhere where it's an entertainment. Maybe it's just one of those things. It was too far ahead of its time.
Well, you know, if we're talking about things that kind of got a bit of a second life in the arcade, and this was quite interesting. I kind of heard about this before, but the book explained it well, because, I mean, obviously the Amiga CD32, that was kind of Commodore's last-ditch attempt at the Amiga before they went bankrupt in 1994. But actually that got a second life as a system called the Cubo CD32. So what kind of happened there?
Yeah, I'm kind of fascinated by all this second life stuff. You know, what happens to machines that don't sell well? They don't just disappear. They end up becoming something else. And, you know, we saw it with the Atari Jaguar, which ended up, the mold for that ended up being used as a piece of dental equipment. Yeah. I mean, that was quite a famous story. And the CD32, some of them ended up being sent to Canada and used as banking machines. So that a form of internet banking. But some of them ended up in Italy. And this company bought them and turned them into what they call the Cubo CD32. All the Commodore branding was removed. And they created these kind of like little drives that kind of PCB boards, I should say, that plug into it, and then hooked it up into an arcade cabinet and made it into a quiz machine. So you'd see these things in bars playing these kind of simple quiz games, and a few games that were kind of like copied from games like Buster Move and stuff like that. And those few kind of poker games and things, stuff like that. But then if you opened up the machine, just inside was a CD32. Later on, they moved on to like PCs. I spoke to one of the people who worked at the company, and they said that basically it started running out of CD32s. There was only a limited amount. Of course, Commodore weren't producing anymore. And as they burned out, they started replacing them with PCs.
I'd love to see one working, you know, because it's got that jammer interface. So you're right. It is just a CD32 on an arcade, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. I don't think they were being particularly pushed with the games they were playing, but yeah, kind of interesting to kind of see where this thing ended up. What happens when a big company like Commodore folds? You know, what happens to all that inventory? Where does it go? You know,
at least they found some use for it, not just in a skip or something. Yeah, so
that's true. Yeah,
yeah. Well, Lewis, it's been a fascinating insight into the lesser, more obscure oddities from the world of video games. And obviously, if people have enjoyed what we've been talking about for the last hour, there's loads more like this in the book as well. A really interesting read. How do people get hold of the book?
Yeah, sure. Well, you can order it direct from the publishers, Pen and Sword. So if you just search Curious Video Game Machines, Pen and Sword, you should be able to find a direct link there. It's also on Amazon, Waterstones, WH Smith, all of those things. So if you just search Curious Video Game Machines, you should be able to find it. And it's also available in the US as well, in the United States. That's via Casemate. And also you'll find it on US Amazon.
Great. Well, I'll put these links in the show notes as well, so people can click straight through. And hopefully, like you said, you know, if you know, people should definitely go out and support this, because, like you said, there's hopefully enough for a second volume as well. So I do think it's important that these lesser known tales are recorded for history.
That's right. Yeah, buy my book so I can do another one.
That's it. Well, Lewis, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on and being our guest this week.
Thank you. It's been fun.